And if you have questions about Botswana in particular or South Africa, we've got somebody here that can answer a lot of your questions. So he's not going to do the presentation, but he is up here to help answer questions that you might have. And so you're welcome to direct your questions at LT. And so I'm going to ask him to come up and do some prayers and start this segment.
Let us pray.
So I'm Sean, I know most of you guys, and this past January, I had an opportunity to go to Cote d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast, which is in West Africa. So I want to tell you just a couple things about that trip in my time. But before I do that, I want to give you some background on kind of where that trip all started for me. Because really, the planning for that trip was about 6 years in the making. My first time in this camp was 2012. I was 15 years old, and I bet some of you guys can relate to this. I was very spiritually disinterested and unfocused, and this camp really encouraged me and helped me refocus my life in a lot of ways. And one of those ways was thinking about Port of Angels. There's some guys who talked about going overseas and working with people and sharing the gospel with the lost. And so when I heard those guys talk about that, it's not something that I really considered in the past. And I thought, why not? What would hold me back from going to these places to share the gospel with people who need it? And so I talked to Gary about that a couple months later, and he kind of suggested that I think about moving to a place that speaks a different language to share the gospel with those people. So I thought, okay, cool deal. And that kind of became my life plan after that. I had already taken French in high school a little bit, and so Gary suggested that I continue to work with my French and that I continue to grow spiritually. And so that's what I did. And when I first took French, I took it because everybody else took Spanish, and so I wanted to take something different, which is pretty lame. But so I didn't realize this. So I went to Cote d'Ivoire, I went to Abidjan. Why that place? Well, I bet a lot of people are like me, and I didn't know that all those places in blue right there, if you can see that map, those are considered French-speaking Africa. There's a lot of places in Africa that speak French. I had no idea. There are about 120 million people in Africa who speak French. The country that I visited there in Orange is Cote d'Ivoire. About 24 million people there. Most of them speak French. And the city that I visited is Abidjan, which has about 5 million people. That's a big city. And about 99% of them speak French. And I don't know personally of any Christians going over there to share the gospel with them. And so that's why I desired to go over there. So that was 6 years ago. 6 years of working on French and trying to grow spiritually by the grace of God, neither one of those things as much as I needed to. But I had an opportunity to go. And so that's what I did this past January. Who I went with? I went with Micaiah Sterling, Greg Sterling. A lot of you guys know Micaiah. I went with him and his dad. So it was a good opportunity. They went with me. That was a blessing. So I want to tell you just a couple things about that trip. First, the things that we were thinking about, the goals of our trip. I had never been to Cote d'Ivoire. I don't know anybody who had been to Cote d'Ivoire. I didn't know anybody from there. And so I was like, we got to figure some stuff out. So first goal of this trip was to explore. There's only so many things you can look up on Wikipedia. And so we had to figure some things out. How do we get around in this country? What are things like here? And the second part of this trip was to make contacts. Like I said, I didn't know anybody here. So we were trying to meet people, ask them to teach us about their country. And through that, by God's grace, to open up opportunities speak to them about the Lord. So those are really our two goals. And there was one other thing in the back of my mind and that was, can and should I move here? Because for like 6 years, this is all I wanted to do. If people knew me really well, they'd know this is where I want to go. And so, can I really do this? Should I do this? That was in my mind. So we get to Abidjan, and that's in the back of my mind. But I should tell you first, right before I went, I talked with another friend of mine who had visited Africa and thinking about moving there. He had the same question in his mind. He said that he got off the plane, and he's thinking, can and should I move here? He looks around. Yeah, I can do it. And he just loved it. It was an amazing trip for him, and he was able to be used by the Lord. So I get off the plane. I had that in the back of my mind. I successfully get out of the airport using just French, no English. And I look around, and I think, what am I doing here? Like, that's no joke. But I felt, Sean, you don't know anybody here. You don't speak this language very well. I just felt completely out of my element, and like I had no business being in this place. And to be honest with you guys, that feeling persisted. I had a pit in my stomach for the first several days that I was in this country. And I share that with you because, you know, the idea of going to Africa, the idea of doing foreign evangelism sounds really cool, doesn't it? In some ways, it sounds adventurous, it sounds noble. In some ways, it is. So I had a lot of time in 6 years to romanticize, to think it was going to be really cool. And then I got over there, and reality set in. And that was helpful. That was a blessing from the Lord that happened to me. But I want you guys to think about that as well. If you ever think about foreign evangelism, really, we got to get our focus off of ourselves and realize this is about teaching the lost. This is about glorifying God. So just a couple quick stories about my time while I was there. Those are just some pictures of Abidjan. I don't have time to go through all the pictures, and it wouldn't mean much to you guys anyway because you've never been there. But anyway, so we get off the plane. There's this lady that's supposed to pick us up from the airport because I would have had no idea where to go if she didn't. So she does. She gets inside this taxi, and she's sitting, and then Micaiah, he's conked out sleeping, and then I'm right next to him. And she's trying to make conversation, and it's all in French, which was a big deal for me. I've spoken in French with a lot of people in the U.S., but any time that we don't understand each other or I don't understand them, we just switch back to English. Well, there was no switching back to English. She didn't know any English because they speak French in her country. So she's talking to me, and I'm having trouble understanding. There's wind going around, there's cars going, and I'm not getting what she's saying very well. So that was starting to discourage me again. And then she asks a question that I knew what she was talking about. She says, what are you doing here? And kind of like that, too. Like, why are you here? It doesn't make any sense. But I was ready for that question. Beforehand, I had thought through, if somebody asked me that question, it's an opportunity. I can tell them that we're here because we're Christians. We care about the Lord. We care about others. And we want to share the gospel with them. So I told her that in French. And she understood what I said. And she kind of looked at me and she said, well, how do you expect to convert people when your French is so bizarre? Yeah. Ouch. Yeah, it was funny. But it really hurt. Like, 6 years working on French, I've flown all the way to this country, I don't know anybody, I already feel inadequate, and here this lady's making me feel more inadequate. So I told her that was a fair question. It humbled me, which was good, and it was a fair question. And part of this trip was for me to practice and evaluate where my French was. I worked on this language, but really until you go a place, from other people that I've talked to, you're not really going to be as fluent as you could be. And it was a good opportunity. I practiced, I worked on my French, and by the end of the trip, there were times, one time a guy asked me something in English. He said, where are you from? Somehow he knew we were Americans, he said that. And I said, je viens de les États-Unis, just because that was what my response always was in French, which is, I'm from America. And so it helped me to practice, it helped me to evaluate my French and different things like that. So here's a couple pictures of Abidjan. It's kind of a mixture. It's an interesting city. You have areas that are very much so third world and areas that are really nice. So in that top left-hand side, that's that's right-hand side for you guys. That's a mall, and it's really nice. And then you have the marketplace on the other side, which really stunk a lot. And so just a couple different pictures there. So I shared with you that while I was there, I had that pit in my stomach. And thanks be to God, that started to dissipate the longer that I was there because of a couple things. One, as we figured more things out, that was helpful. Two, as we connected more with people, that was also helpful. The people there were very kind. They were encouraging. I think they could tell we had no idea what we were doing, so they wanted to be helpful to us. And because it's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard work. And make sure that your focus is on the Lord. Those are two things that I struggle with, and that's what I want to share with you guys. So, yeah. Mr. Joseph.
I marked about half of my notes because Sean just said those things. Let me start off. Raise your hand if you've ever been involved in evangelism. Keep your hand up if you've ever been involved in foreign evangelism. Everybody just put your hand down, put your hand back up. If you've been involved in evangelism, you've been involved in foreign evangelism. Am I right? We are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. We are all on foreign soil. I think it's something that's helpful for me to keep in mind when I go to another country. I'm in another country, not just because it's Indiana. It's too easy. Anywhere and everywhere to do that. My opportunity began, I want to start the story in 10th grade. Some of you have heard this before. I took Spanish because everybody was taking Spanish, and I knew the guys that were in there, and I could cheat with them. And so I took Spanish for 2 years in high school. At the end of that 2 years, I could say fluently, Pepe, escupio chicle. Which means, Pepe was my nickname, and Escupio Chicle means spit out your gum. Because every day, I was a horrible student. I challenged authority all the time. We were not chewing gum in school. I went into class every day chewing gum to see how long I could get by without Senor O'Leary catching me. And so we had this process, each Spanish class, he would find me in the classroom somewhere and see me chewing the gum. And Pepe, Escupio Chicle. I'd have to go over and spit out my gum in the trash can. 2 years of Spanish, that's what I accomplished. Really proud of myself. I thought it was so cool. Cheated every test. Knew nothing about Spanish and got C's. One of my highest grades, actually, in class. but it gave me no value at all. And then, because of Gary, I go to prison later on in life. Gary gets the opportunity to teach some Bible studies in prison. Those opportunities grow and grow. Finally, the chaplain comes to Gary and says, listen, you're taking up too much time in the visitor's room. If you mind just moving to the chapel in the middle of the prison and conducting group studies there. And Gary's like, sure, I'd love to. So he gets Tommy Peeler to come along. The two of them are going to teach. They need somebody for logistics, like to handle the keys and the walkie-talkie. And I was a brand new Christian. Didn't know much about the Bible or anything. Less Spanish. But Gary and I had met each other. He called me and said, hey, would you like to go to prison? I was like, sure. So I start going in, and for every Thursday, I get to sit for 2 hours and listen to Gary and Tommy, an hour each. And all I have to do is radio people back and forth to their cells and that sort of thing. But I learned just tremendous for those 2 years. And that ends up turning into Tommy moves away. I start doing some teaching. Gary moves away. Some other people start coming in. I'm there for 7 years doing that. But in those first few years of that process, Gary and Dennis decide that they're going to explore, kind of like what John was talking about, going to Brazil. I'm hanging out with Gary a lot at that time. And Beth and I are newly married, and we began to hear what they're thinking about doing and their exploratory trips and so forth. We said, well, maybe we should do that. And, I mean, I have no experience. I never thought anything about that before, but it just seemed like a good thing. So I wrote Gary, and I asked him. I said, do you think that Beth and I should go to? And he wrote me a letter. This is pre-texting and emailing and all that stuff. He wrote me a letter. I still have that letter. Amongst the things that he said in that letter was, why am I going to Brazil? It's because no one else is going. And that just really hit me. No one else is going. And so I need to go. And so Beth and I decided, well, we should go too. And so we decided to join in with that and try to learn the language and get to know Brazil, made some trips, ended up moving there. We lived in Brazil for 2 years, twice, with about a two-year break in between. Here's a picture of, this is, I think at the time this picture was taken, if I'm not mistaken, it was like it ranked number 3 in neighborhoods of murder rate, something like that, 2nd or 3rd in the world in murder rates, Parque Santo Antonio, neighborhood in Sao Paulo. Murders every night, multiple. It is a horrible, horrible place. And you just think, can anything good come out of that? And we have our group Bible study here. This is one of their group Bible studies. Not nearly as nice conditions. There's a bunch of young people there that love the Lord and wanted to grow. And this kind of arrangement in Brazil taught me that if you will fall in love with the people that you're with, any place can be home. And I think that that's really a big key to what we call foreign evangelism, going to another country. We lived in Brazil for 4 years. Let's see, I've got so many slides on the border, don't I? Well, that's okay. Let's skip ahead to some of this. We lived in Brazil in 95, 96, then 98, 2000. 2007, we decided my wife and I had 6 kids at the time. First time we went, we had 2 kids. Second time we had 3 kids. Now we have 6 kids. We're like, we probably ought to go back to Brazil. It'd be good to engage in that work again. So we began to get rid of our furniture, put our house up for sale, told the congregation we were leaving, began to submit papers to the Brazilian consulate. Long story short, they turned us down. The door was closed. We're not going to go. I thought, what in the world am I going to do now? And I remember calling Sewall and said, Sewall, we're Brazil. The consulate just gave us the word. We're not going to go to Brazil again. So what should we do? I said, don't do anything. He said, churches will find out that you're available and they'll call you. And by the way, Fairlawn is looking for a preacher. I'm going to give them your name. They called me a week later. I ended up moving to the Northeast. Never dreamed about going to the Northeast. Last time I've been there was in basic training. I hated New Jersey. but I ended up moving there. At less than an hour south of where I moved, there's a Brazilian congregation. I got to work with them 6 months every year. I taught their adult class. So having learned Portuguese gave me opportunities even back in the United States. Made some trips periodically to Brazil. But then I went through a span of time where I just got caught up in the work in Jersey and the Northeast and didn't make the trips. Early 2015, I'd like to go back and visit the brethren, sort of a coalesce kind of emotion there. So I called Gary and I said, I knew that he'd been making several trips to Brazil and various places. And I didn't know as much about what was going on. I said, hey Gary, I'm thinking about making another trip and interested, do you have an opinion about where I should go? He said, yeah, how about Mozambique? No, we're talking about Brazil. I didn't say Brazil, I just assumed. He says, how about Mozambique? I'm going in a couple of months and I don't have anybody going with me. Would you be interested? Okay, Mozambique also speaks Portuguese. So that's one of the reasons for it. So Mozambique is this country down here on the east side of Africa, just north of South Africa, just east of Zimbabwe. And so Gary and I make a trip to the Mozambique together. It was in the tents. Pretty close, at least. But he has a ton of work to do back to, now, there, Mike and I went in 2017, I'm sorry, 2016. Some of you heard the story about how we were, I don't have any slides, I guess, in order. Here's something I want to mention. This is at the time of the collection. The offering is being taken up, and this pink bag right here is a bag of beans. Back over here is some peanuts. You wouldn't normally think about that as a part of the collection. When you're in another country, don't just Americanize everything. Don't base everything on the way that we do things. You know, their culture, that's what one family had to give. So they gave a bag of beans at the collection. I just think about, well, it's pretty practical. If it's going to support evangelists, and that preacher can take those home, or whatever the case. So that was kind of a new thing for me to experience. This picture is really dark. It's hard to see. But we've been preaching all day. Mike and I have been. And in the course of the time, we are taking some breaks. But when we take a break, all of the men get together in groups, and they study even more. All day long that was going on. And that's why I go to Mozambique, because there's a lot of people that want to study God's word and want to grow. This hut here gives me shivers. Right out in front of this hut, Micah and I faced an extortioner. If we were going to leave this city without harm coming to us, we were going to have to give up some money. He was called a brother, and it was a, I don't have time to tell you the whole story. Horrible. Probably the most traumatic event that's ever happened in my life. Fearful. Very. Had my son with me. Don't know what's going to happen. We made it through that. But it reminded me that for every Thessalonica, there's a Berea. And so, Nampula, Mulivala, is where Jonasi robbed us. The very next town that we went to was Beira. Beira is my Berea. And these are the brethren that I was able to then study with. And when I told them about that, these two gentlemen, Noé over on your left and Nevis on the right, when I told them the story, they were outraged. And Noé, he's a big guy. He's just a Hulk kind of fellow. And as soon as I tell him what Jonas does, he says, "Listen, he will not come here. And if he does, I will take care of him." Whoa. I said, "Okay, let's not resort to violence." But they were just very concerned. They wanted to comfort me and let me know that Mike and I were going to be taken care of. That's one thing that was helpful, was to see that I was there thinking I was going to help them. They ended up being a great blessing and comfort to me. Some of these pictures are hard to see. This is a Mozambican kitchen. It's just three bricks with some wood split in the middle. Not very fancy kitchen arrangement. This little block building here, that's the bathroom that we had to use. It's about a 3 foot by 3 foot or so bathroom. There's the inside of the bathroom. And what I mean by bathroom, not to be too crude, but here is where you would aim to go number one. You would remove this stone to go number two. And that is the same area where you would put a 5-gallon bucket where you would take a shower. And so sometimes when you go overseas, you may face some conditions that are less than cabin-esque, okay? You should be prepared for that. Gary's lesson on frogs, another night of frogs, the plague. One night in Mozambique, I woke up and was in my sleeping bag, and right here on my sleeping bag is this frog staring at me. I reached over, grabbed the camera, took a picture of it. It wasn't Pharaoh, it wasn't all of them, but too fascinating. One thing you've got to keep in mind is the women that do work. It's incredible to see the work that women do in foreign countries. These women I greatly appreciated because they provided the opportunities for us to be able to study, just working diligently all day long. This picture is really special. I'm on this motorcycle down here, riding on the back a bit, which I don't feel as comfortable. I'd rather be driving. But I snapped this picture of the motorcycle in the front because you can't recognize that individual. But there's a really good lesson right here. Yeah, just not. But he did it for the love of the brethren. You know, sometimes we put ourselves in uncomfortable situations, and this picture is really special to me. I've got some other pictures here that I love to do. But this one is special because it shows me the attitude of somebody who wants to sacrifice and preach the gospel and is willing to do, get out of that comfort zone to do that. Sometimes that's required. My last trip to Mozambique was not to preach, but a couple of cyclones had come through. The first one came through. This was the first scene. I get off the airport. I walk in, walking into the airport, and there are sacks and sacks and sacks of beans. There's also flour back over here as well. Rice. This is rice. This is flour over here. There was a cyclone that came through Mozambique, killed hundreds and hundreds of people, displaced thousands more. Terrible. Here's a couple of the houses that we drove by into this village where Christians lived. So this pile of straw here used to be a building, a house just like this. This was somebody's house that the cyclone had just destroyed. They probably had a couple of pots and pans, had a few clothes, all of that completely blown away. It was a horrible situation to walk into. This was a trip that I dreaded going. I thought about the letter that you wrote me back in 87, I guess it was. And my conclusion, I did not want to make this trip. But the reason why I made the trip was because nobody else was going. Somebody needed to go and encourage Mozambican brethren. And so when I came, I saw scenes like this. And when we pulled up into the village, as I'm just like crying, thinking about the devastation there, this elderly woman comes just dancing out of her hut, just jumping up and down. She's like the lame man in Acts 3 who's leaping and dancing and praising the Lord. She's just jumping up and down as we pull in. And she just runs to me and shakes my hand because we're bringing food to them. They're not going to starve. We're so bringing them. This is a separate trip Tim brought home, my son-in-law, and I made to Victoria, Seychelles. You'll catch on. We're singing a song here that Stephen wrote, Every Language, Let Every Language, right? We taught that, Tim taught that to the brethren there. Pretty special to think about singing that song in other countries. But while we were there, my goal, my aim in preaching in other places has been to spend my time, because I learned Portuguese in spite of not learning Spanish, is to go to Portuguese-speaking countries. So I've gone to Brazil, Mozambique, Portugal, a couple small churches. As we're getting ready to make this trip, Tim says, hey, would you mind if we stop over at Seychelles? And I was like, okay. We're communicating on the phone. He doesn't see my face, but I'm like, I don't want to go to an English-speaking country. Other people can go there. I'd really spend my time in Portuguese-speaking countries. It was by far the most valuable part of this trip. Just a few months, about 3 months before we make this trip, there's an accident. This couple here, their daughter is killed in an accident. Here's a picture of Lilia. What has happened is, in their house one night there's a storm. They live at the base of a mountain, and a rock dislodges up the top of the mountain, rolls down the mountain, and comes through right into this, where this wall has now been rebuilt. And that was their bedroom. A few hours before, Lilia had gotten scared in the night and had crawled into bed with her parents, right in between them. The rock rolled right down the middle of the bed. Scraped mom, did not touch the dad, but crushed their daughter. And we're going to go to this church. Isolated island out in the Indian Ocean. I have almost no contact with the Christians elsewhere. And I'm thinking, what in the world are we going to say to somebody like that? And so we have lunch with them on Tuesday, and basically we just sit around and cry together. We just let them tell us about Lilia and about what happened. And I had talked to Scott and Bertina, talked to Simon and Teresa beforehand, wanting to get perspectives from individuals who have children who have died. And so we talked a little bit about Adam and Kelsey, and spent a lot of time talking about Lilia, brought out photo books and so forth. Just very hard, very uncomfortable setting. I think it's important to keep in mind that you're going to face some of those kinds of things. But this was on Tuesday, the last day that we're going to be in Victoria. There is a baptism, and here is Jean-Marc. One of the things that Simon and Teresa had done is sent some of their shirts for Lily's parents and siblings, so you can see the shirt life's more interesting when you're happy. That was very special to think about the impact that not only that we had had, but others who were concerned about them and were concerned about our trip. I'm barely touching the hem of the garment. I just want you to see that there's some things that are very uncomfortable about going overseas, but there is tremendous reward and great blessings in everybody that I touch, touches me. And it's just, I've fallen in love with every place that I've been. And now I have mothers and brothers and sisters all over the world.
So many things prepared me for the opportunity. We were homeschooling our children. My daughter had an assignment in her homeschool manual. Write a letter to a missionary. So she comes to me, hey Dad, do you know any missionaries? Well, I knew the Beckley family. They had been in the United States when I started preaching. And I said, yes, they'd gone back to South Africa. So why don't you write a letter to the Beckleys? And she did. And Joanne Beckley wrote her back. And Abby's like, wow, this is great. I want to learn more about this. Well, I knew David needed help over in South Africa. And so we began to think, maybe we could be more helpful than we are just writing a letter. My wife has an extended family. She had two great aunts that passed away with no children. They left all their great nieces and nephews a sizable sum of money. And so I called my friend Harbinder. He's a world-class banker over in England, works in the city of London. He has a gold company in India. I said, Harbinder, I've got this money. What should I do with it? Well, he said, you can pay down your debts, invest it in stocks, and watch it grow. Or you can do something that you would never do otherwise. Take a trip. And so Sarah and I prayed about it. We talked about it with family. We talked it over at Bethlehem. So we took the whole family over for the summer and worked with David and Joanne. David said, these people need to see entire families doing it God's way. They don't see that in so many countries. And so that was my opportunity to go over there. Now, a couple of things that I want to just sort of cover. One is, we often get appeals to help people over there. Don't do that unless you know the character and you can trust them. There's a lot of money that corrupts people in other countries. For instance, there was a GoFundMe account a few years ago for a young man, preacher in Zimbabwe, and that GoFundMe account was to raise money for fertilizer. Well, he can't tell where the fertilizer came from, he can't tell how much it costs, and you can't tell where it went. This is a government depot that has free fertilizer. People are sending money, and he can go pick up a couple bags, take a picture, and say, hey, I got fertilizer, thank you very much for the money. They don't always think in the ways that we think, so we need to be aware of that and be very careful. I'm sure the other guys that do some of this work will agree with me. I have people on my Facebook as friends because I want to know what they're up to, not because I trust them. So don't have somebody write to you on Facebook just because they're a friend of mine. Don't assume that they're a friend that I would trust. Contact me first before you do anything like that. You have to be sensitive to their culture. Okay, this is a typical dish in Zimbabwe. We've got salsa over here, we've got some greens, collard greens, and we've got some chicken feet. We usually don't get the feet of chicken in our country, but in those countries it's very tasty and it's considered important. I have learned as an American and as a preacher, I'm usually served first. I've also learned that if I clean my plate, there's probably a 12-year-old that's not going to eat. So I don't clean my plate. I let the 12-year-old have something to eat. I take clothes. I go to the Goodwill store before I go over. I buy an old suitcase and I buy clothes that I intend to leave over there. And I'll usually give them to my host and let them have something that they can either wear or sell in exchange. I don't need it back here. So it does a double purpose. For body worms. Remember eat caterpillars? Anybody? Simon, have you had potty worms?
Not yet.
Okay. Andy, have you? Okay. Tastes like cardboard, okay? But it's a delicacy over there. I've seen a girl picking bugs off a car windshield at a car lot to eat. That was going to be her meal for the day. There are some very difficult things you have to be ready for. There are some wonderful things. I have two chickens in Zimbabwe. I will never see them again. I gave them away. But they were given to me by people that really couldn't afford very much. I went over in 2016 to give food relief, and they brought me food. And this woman here, this is a widow, first of all, knows that they go on their knees. They respect you. They honor you. She went back to her hut. This is the type of sugar cane. It's not even very commercial sugar cane. This is what she grows. They can cut a piece off and sort of suck on it a little bit. She gave me two stalks of that. People that don't have much sometimes are more generous than people that have a lot. So these are some of the places that I've been. Cameroon, I'll talk about that. Tanzania, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa, I've been to the area. Cameroon. I remember last spring, this is going back a little bit, but there's a terrible situation there. The country is divided by language. And those of you that haven't studied language, if you want to learn a language, you have to learn how people think in that language. And so the English and the French think in very different ways. And they cannot get together, they cannot get along. So I went with Ed Brandt, so we call ourselves at number one, at number two, we could choose everybody that way. And we went with Eddie Paul, so we had Ed and Eddie. We went up into the English-speaking zone, and Eddie Paul's grandmother is right here. She's now 101 years old. I wrote to Eddie Paul this morning to find out she's still with us. Her husband was the first one converted out of paganism into Christianity. Eddie Paul's father became a preacher, passed away when Eddie Paul was 18 years old. He went over to Nigeria, studied preaching over there, came back. 22 years old, his mother passed away. And so here's a man that has been on his own basically since he was your age. The northwest area, sometimes you have to, you know, find where the road is. It may not look like a road. Then you have to park and walk. You pass all kinds of places as you go. And when you get up there, you find out that they wrote a special sign welcoming you to their services. This building was built to hold 80 people in 2015. I went there, they had 87 people there in 2016. They're talking about how can we expand our building. Then Civil War broke out. Checkpoints along the way, bad roads, that's a typical road. Typical bridge, a couple potholes on there. And then we got pulled over by police, security checkpoint. One of these policemen had been murdered that morning, and they were watching everybody going through the zone. He held us up for about 45 minutes. He wanted to arrest us. He wanted to take us to their capital building, or their capital city, which is like 5 hours away. We ended up paying him about $10, and a promise that we would straighten out my visa. My visa was their problem, but it's my visa. Straighten that out when we got back to the big city. So you never know what you're going to run into. Preaching in Zimbabwe one time, a couple of guys in machine guns started coming towards me. I know what was up. There were prison guards, and where we were meeting had been a lumber yard. They're interested in lumber. They didn't care about me. But you don't know that when you're up there preaching. These brethren have now taken in refugees from that area in Cameroon. They can't afford to live themselves, much less support two or three other people that are living with them. But that's their responsibility as Christians, and they know this. So just as of today, this is the summer of 2018, the number of people of concern in Cameroon increased by 88%. So we have over 320,000 refugees in Cameroon. Not only that, we have over 600,000 displaced people. Now, those people aren't categories as refugees because they've got relatives and family that they don't live with, but they're not at home. And so there are a lot of Christians that are being burdened right now trying to take care of their own brother just because they speak a different language and they think in different terms. Sometimes the best people that you meet in terms of contacts have to be the hotel workers. Alina is a Muslim. She's 26 years old. She's a single mother of a 4-year-old daughter. And as we were speaking with the English people, we were offering them Bibles. She was one of their translators. And so I asked her, would you like a Bible in English? Because they all wanted French Bibles. And she said, sure. Because she can read an English Bible and a lot of people won't know she's reading. And so we've had some Skype studies and some text changes on certain things in the Bible. So there are opportunities both in different places. I was able to find many places where you don't necessarily have to speak another language. I studied French in 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 5th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade. College came along, I had 101, 102, 201, 202. And when I got to Paris, France at the age of 26, I could buy a train ticket and that was about all. I got to Africa. They're a lot more patient with my French in Africa than they are in France, I'll tell you that. But they take pity on you and switch to English. This is getting to the next city. Again, we gave Bibles to the hotel workers. These two women are Muslim. This man is probably Muslim, but he could care less about God right now. But he did pay attention to the free Bibles. Tanzania, Dar es Salaam is where I went this spring. It is the fastest growing city in Africa. It has grown 3 million people in the last 2 years. They expect to have 75 million people by the end of the century. Now, just in terms of comparison, Tokyo will pale in comparison. They want to be the major import hub for all of Africa for the Indian and Chinese trade. So they're building deep water ports that go miles out to sea so they can have these huge freighters come in and unload so that they can take it into the interior of Africa. They're on track. They're doing all kinds of things. They're pushing traditional peddlers out of the city center and putting in high-speed bus lines to get people in and out quickly. There are about 11 congregations in the city of Dar es Salaam. Most of them are run and organized by institutional brethren, but we have invitations to go back to all 11 congregations now and present to them the New Testament pattern of the church. Most of those congregations average 70 people. I think your congregation is about 25 people. I said, how many of you have preached for a small congregation? Half the hands went up. I said, how big is the congregation? They said 70. I would love to have 70 people. I worked with this man, Zabara. And this man, Godwin, both of them were Muslim. Godwin converted to Christianity, and then when Zubair was looking into Islam, Godwin got a hold of him and converted him to Christianity. Zubair earns about $4 a day on a good day. He doesn't have enough money to support himself right now. Question is, will he be corrupted if somebody starts making him a rich man? I don't know. But they give out Bibles. We bought Bibles because they have people who are willing to do door knocking, but nothing to offer. You want to have a Bible study? Sure. Where's your Bible? So they did that. Godwin has written several tracts in Swahili, How to Convert a Muslim. He's got some good resources. So Zubair wrote me a couple days ago, brother, when you come back to Africa, we can go into southern Tanzania. The border between Tanzania and Mozambique is a Muslim land. They need a gospel. No congregation there. A lot of people, they're lost. That's his thinking. I never thought I'd go preach the gospel to Muslims. But here's an opportunity. Zambia. We went from up in here, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, over to Zambia. A lot of people have worked in Zambia along the Zimbabwe border. We're in the central area. And lot to talk about that in terms of what we did. We met with a couple of congregations, that was good, but we're flying on Ethiopian Airlines. I'm feeling bad because we got the old plane, right? It's got the old TV monitor over the aisle, so you sort of have to cream to watch anything. It's got a safety video that you can't even understand. And so as we taxi out, I see all these really nice planes all lined up, thinking, why can't I be on one of those? Well, 3 days later, one of those planes crashed out of Addis Ababa in Kenya. You have to be careful sometimes. God is watching over us in spite of ourselves. And so we had actually planned to go to Kenya on this trip, and we changed our plans during the process because we just didn't have enough time. We got on Ethiopian Airlines 3 days after the crash. And you should have seen the flight attendants. They lost friends on those flights. We also happened to be there when the cyclone hit. Ed Brand got trapped in Malawi. When the cyclone first hit, it went inland and devastated Malawi. Then it went back over the ocean, built up some steam, and then came back and devastated Mozambique and part of Zimbabwe. So we had to delay some of our plans up there. And we left. We left this area just as it was starting to rain. This is Trimor Tizola's report here. Trying to get in there, and we have a brother Christ who's staying in this area. His wife is missing since this destruction took place. We're not sure if she is still that safe. They have not recovered her body. This woman's ankle was broken when her house collapsed on her. She's been helped. This family lost their huts. They got it rebuilt. There's another man we're trying to help. The builder died yesterday. So now we've got to find a builder we can trust to build some more houses. So how did you guys get started? You've heard some of the good, you've heard some of the bad. How did you get into this? Well, I went to Jamaica this last year with Shannon Stinson and David Tantz. David has gone down to Jamaica for about 35 years. I know him on the streets as the preacher. And where's Isaac? Back there, okay? So if you want to find out more about Jamaica, Isaac's the guy to see, okay? So his sister Rosie is right here. This trip does a lot of service. We did some construction stuff. I have a background doing construction, so we did a lot of that. David and I went off and had some Bible studies with some Muslims, and it was a very profitable time to encourage the brethren with these young people coming to see them. They're there now with a group that does vacation Bible schools. And so these are places that I have standing invitations. When are you going to come help us? When are you going to come see us? I don't even consider India. There are other people that do India, that go to India. I just don't see how I can get there and continue doing some of the work I've already started. So, Isaac, I don't know if I can trust this man or not. Other people have written him off. He wants me to come, and he is doing a work. I don't know if it's a good work yet, but he's doing a work, and he's got young people involved doing it. Brother Smith, greetings from the war. We've heard from Brother Frank Walton. We need you. That's it. Come to find out, in Ethiopia, several Americans started going there in the 1980s. Those men are now too old to make the trip. And he's saying, who's coming now? We still need people to come, and we still need people to help us. Frank wrote me, I hope you are well. Joseph Muturi in Kenya said the large gathering of brothers in Western Kenya may be up to 400 people. And when they use those numbers, they're talking 400 adults. He was wondering if a South American preacher would come speak. Joseph emailed such and such. I would love an opportunity to go over and speak to 400 people. They're there. They want to hear. But then I have things like this. The United States Embassy, U.S. Embassy, to force the torture dismemberment and beheading of a general in the southwest region of Cameroon. We also condemned the report of beheading of a Cameroon soldier in Bamenda. That was the city where the soldier that pulled us over. In the northwest region, we extend our condolences to their families. And then they issue alerts. If you're going to do overseas work, you need to understand some of these things. Level number 4, do not travel. The United States government is telling me if I go to those areas, they will not come get me. I'm on my own. If I get sick, there's not a medical facility to help me there. And then I get this, Betty Paul, do you have any plans for Cameroon this year? Will you be visiting so as to work with the French congregations? He knows we won't be able to go into the English congregations. I will be glad if that will be the case. So your heart goes out. There are people that want the gospel. I wish I could speak French. I gave it some serious effort even before I went back over to Africa. I didn't get that gene. Maybe someday I'll be able to learn something. I amuse people. I open doors by rumbling around in Shona or Swahili. They appreciate the attempt. But I'm never going to be able to convert somebody in their language. I'm going to depend on translators. But you guys have some language ability. Use it. You can use it from here. You can help translate material. You can send things over to them. I'm probably way over time. But I hope that you'll consider what you can do. Not what you can't do, but what you can do. The Chinese are thick in Africa. Learn Chinese. I keep telling the African brother, you're going to have some missionaries in my country someday because the situation is horrible here. But you also need to be teaching the Chinese because they'll take that gospel home with them when they go back to China. So God opens all kinds of doors for us. We just have to be willing to step in.